We can go ahead and get started.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning into another episode of the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And today we're taking kind of a different topic. Usually we either talk about comic books or superhero RPGs. Today we're dipping a toe into the bigger pond of fantasy RPGs, and we have one of the authors of the Monster Manual for D&D Next on the call with us, and that would be Mr. Steve Townsend. How you doing, Steve?
Pretty well, thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you. We also have two of our regular co-hosts, Mr. Walt Rebillard.
That happens.
Hey, Walt.
Gentlemen.
And Dr. Comics, a.k.a. Jason Tondro.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for coming, by the way, Steve. That's very kind of you. Is everyone in the office like doing all these podcasts to sort of pump the game?
Well, you know, I'm a freelancer, so I work on my own in Chicago, where all those guys are out in Seattle.
So you're not like a full-time WotC guy. You're a freelancer.
Yeah, I'm a freelancer, and sometimes I feel like a full-time guy because I have a string of projects that go one to the next to the next. But I'm a freelancer. So like Rob Schwalb, who's another big freelancer who worked on this book, I write independently for Wizards.
Well, you're going to hear lots and lots of envy over the next year. From all of us, I expect.
Well, yeah, Jason and Walt and myself, we all do small press RPG stuff, mainly PDFs and RPG Now. But you kind of go into the big show. You're in the big leagues.
It's odd because I play, I play a lot of small press RPGs. That's probably mostly what I've been playing these days.
Are you a Dogs in the Vineyard guy?
Say again?
Are you a Dogs in the Vineyard guy?
Now, what do you mean by a Dogs in the Vineyard guy?
I only pull it up as a well-known independent game. That's all that I wondered if you played.
You know, I have played Dogs in the Vineyard, and I like... I enjoyed playing it, and I enjoy Vincent Baker's other stuff. I like Apocalypse World. I played a game of Apocalypse World last summer a year ago that was one of the best games that I've been in. And I think the system is great, but I always want to say that any game that I play, it's the players and the storyteller that really make it what it is. And in that particular game, we cooperated really well. But I like those games, but I love a lot of games that are coming out from Avery McDaldno. Ribbon Drive is fantastic. It's one of my favorite games. It's based around a playlist. You can play, and you it's a great way to share your music with other people and make them listen to it, because you put your music on Facebook and nobody listens to it. But if you – and a game that revolves around a playlist where everybody brings their playlist – and the mechanics work on the playlist. It's a great way to make people listen to your music.
That's a great idea.
I have never heard of this game before.
You really need to check it out. It's a game. The mechanic works around a playlist, and it plays in about 3 hours. And it's, you've got to look it up. Look up Buried Without Ceremony is the site, and it's and another one that it was Joe McDaldno. Now it's Avery McDaldno did Monster Hearts, and also. The Quiet Year is a fantastic game where you draw on a map to create your role-playing game. It's based around a deck of cards. I mean, I'm hawking Avery McDaldno's work, but I'm really super impressed with it.
Well, you got to talk about what you love, man. That's
So I'm really liking those small press games, but I'll play anything that comes along. I love Fiasco. I love... recently, Brian Engard's Becoming was a fantastic game I played this year. Polaris also, Microscope. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like a lot of these. Anyway, to answer your question, am I Dogs in the Vineyard guy? I played and enjoyed Dogs in the Vineyard, but I like I like small press games by lots of different authors. So I'll have to check out your stuff as well.
Thank you.
Oh, we had Ben Robinson talking about Microscope. I want to say last year. And we're looking up to get
awesome,
some.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. I'm in fact, my fifth edition game that I just started last week is we built the world this summer using Microsoft.
I got coffee.
So.
Thank you. I think Walt didn't need to hit mute, but yeah, definitely. We actually had Jason Morningstar on, I want to say 18 months ago. He did a demo of Fiasco for us. That was a lot of fun.
Awesome. So. It would have been enviable to be in on that one. I'll have to listen to that.
Yeah, it's like I say, it's about 18 months ago. It was a really good time. We did like about an hour long because Fiasco can be a 2.5-3 hour game. Really.
Oh sure, easily.
My babe.
Well, Walt, could you hit mute, buddy?
Oop. I am on. I was on mute.
Oh, okay.
Did you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, so you heard me talking to my wife?
Yes, yes.
that's weird.
So, Steve, can we talk about your awesome new game?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I have a question for you, since we're talking about the Monster Manual. And you're in a friendly audience here. I think we all love this version of D&D. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, yeah, it's tight.
I've been able to play it and DM it. I've had a lot of fun with it. I know that I was thinking about, well, what questions in particular about the Monster Manual should I ask? And it occurred to me that there's been a long debate in each edition of the Monster Manual over the inclusion of good aligned monsters, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the debate over, well, if you're not going to fight it, why should it be included in the Monster Manual, right?
Yes.
And I was curious, what was the consensus and how did that conversation go down behind the curtain?
You know, it's interesting because we didn't really have it. I mean it's a great question. They gave us a bit. Chris Perkins. Chris Perkins was the lead on this. He was the one who organized the book and gave us our assignments. And by us, I mean myself and Rob Schwab. We divided the book into halves, where I did every other letter. Where I started from A, did C, did E, et cetera, and Rob did the even letters. And Chris gave us our monster assignments, but they were selected, I think, from internally by Wizards R&D, by D&D R&D in the story department. And my impression is that they went through and decided, what are the most iconic monsters to D&D? What are the monsters that people, you know, end up talking about, over all the years, the most important creatures that you find in the book from edition to edition, as well as the things that people that have established a weird niche in the game that are favorites of people's, like Modrons, you know, you don't, or, and Flumps. Everybody talks about Flumps and Modrons. By everybody, I mean people who've played D&D for a number of years. But you don't really encounter them a bunch, I find, but they're a part of the D&D mythology and history that people, you know, are fond of. So those creatures ended up in the book, and so I think that the way that the book was organized by Chris and D&D R&D was that they just wanted to take the stuff that was like the greatest hits. The monsters that were the things that you'd want in a core book. And I think that Chris actually, if he'd had his way, would have made a gigantic book that had every monster in D&D in it. But it wasn't, you know, not practical to do. So there's stuff that I would have liked to see that didn't make the cut that isn't that popular. But as for good monsters.
Such as?
Well, like, you know, for fourth edition, one of the monsters that I got to do is the Cataleptus. And, you know, I'm used to seeing the illustration in Monster Manual 1.
Yeah.
From AD&D. I'm used to seeing it, even though it's a monster that nobody ever really, by nobody, I mean, you know, if you're going to use a monster that turns people to stone, you're probably going to use a basilisk, or you're probably going to use a Medusa, or a Gorgon, maybe. But the Cataleptus doesn't really come up a whole lot. But in fourth edition, I made a story for it
Did you write an article on the fourth edition website about the Cataleptus and like how you wrote it?
Yeah. Bart Carroll, who's the web guy for Wizards, did an interview where I talked about it. And I went back to the mythological roots of the Cataleptus.
I was really impressed by that interview.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. That was in 2009, I think. And so, you know what I mean? I did a lot of work on that monster and thought it was a cool thing. And I would have liked to have seen it come over, but it's not one that people are like, as much work as I did on it, it's not a monster that people are like, you know, I think at the time they thought, well, this is cool, but it's not a monster that, you know, that people are clamoring to see in the the monster manual, I think. But to answer your question, as far as good monsters, I think that, the more iconic ones are brought in, but I also feel that in fourth edition, they included a number of good monsters in the initial monster manual, and they gave, they made them more dangerous. Like they said, the Feywild is a place where, you know, Fey can be, you know, can be good, but they can also be really dangerous. And they sort of did that with the Dryad in fourth edition at the beginning when they made the Dryad kind of scary.
Yeah.
And so as I would get good monsters in assigned to me in fourth edition, or sorry, in this particular monster manual, I would, try to outline their, you know, outline their goals and their aims. And I would also try to throw in reasons that they might conflict with characters. So it's not all, you know, rainbows and butterflies. Any monster that I wrote that has a good background is, it will also have a reason to conflict with characters. The way, I guess the way that a good person might conflict with any other good person. There's tons of, you know, there are many, many good people in the world fighting over and killing each other over things. So.
True. Never spoken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the essay answer to your question.
Well, cool. Are you working on any future projects for D&D Next right now? And D&D Next is what we're calling it, right? Or are we calling it D&D 5th?
I think we're at the point now we're calling it D&D 5th.
Okay, cool.
I think that's what we've, you know, I it's funny because talking to Wizards over the year, you know, it was D&D Next. And then it was sort of D&D, and then in emails I'd get from R&D, it would be 5e. And so I'm just calling it 5e now.
Okay, cool. So when are we going to announce 6th?
You know, that's a good question. I think that in talking to Mike Myrtles way back when, in 2011, when we were talking about a new edition of D&D, where I was like, what? What's going to happen to 4th? I don't want to totally speak for Mike, because he could have changed his mind in the time since I spoke to him, but he really wanted it at the time, and I think this still holds true, is to have an enduring edition of the game where they didn't want to exhaust people on an endless supply of splat books that came out and wore people out and bogged down the game with mechanics. So if you notice what's going on right now, you see these books are announced, and then what else is announced? Adventures. And I don't know anything beyond the next adventure coming out, because I worked on that one.
Can you tell us about that one?
Can you tell us anything about it?
You know, the only thing I can tell you is what's been announced, and that is that Sasquatch Games, which is Rich Baker and Dave Noonan and Steve Schubert, are doing a elemental evil themed.
Oh, sweet.
Big. It was on EN World a few weeks ago, called Princes of the Apocalypse, a giant, you know how right now, Steve Winter and, Wolfgang Bauer did the Horde of the Dragon Queen adventure that is in game stores and is at conventions and is, you know, is a play at home game. The next big one is the Elemental Evil one, which, I guess that's all that has been announced for it. So that's all I can say. But if you look at what's coming out from D&D, it's like they're making adventures. They're not, you know, you're not seeing announcements of, you know, 10 splat books right now. So that's just, and actually, to be honest with you, that's all I know. I don't really know anything other than that. So there could be a ton of stuff that's coming out, but I'm just sort of speculating based on what I've worked on.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I apologize for asking this question because you're not going to be able to answer it, but it's killing me. Do you have any idea what they're going to do in terms of licensing for third-party support?
I actually don't. Huh? I have no. I really don't know. Don't know that answer.
I think Mike wrote that article saying that there was going to be one, but we're going to take probably a year to figure out what it is.
I think that's true. It's funny because it's having a little bit of an inside look on things, and then reading the things that Mike says in interviews, I find that most of the time that Mike is said, a lot of times Mike says, well, maybe this might happen. What it often has meant in historically, I think, is this is something that is happening, probably.
Yeah.
You know, like, but I don't know anything about third party support, but I find that Mike doesn't tend to mention, like, just a whole lot of pie in the sky things. He sort of says what, he presents a lot of possibilities, but a lot of the possibilities he mentions tend to come to fruition.
Yeah. Well, it's probably smart to be a little cagey until you got something really firm, you know.
Yeah, but you know, as far as I've seen so far, like, Kobold Press is doing this, doing the Horde of the Dragon Queen,
mm-hmm.
and Sasquatch is doing the Elemental Evil stuff. So, you say third party support. You've got companies that aren't wizards putting out D&D right now. Yeah. So you sort of do have that, but it's in a way that's coming from Wizards, where Wizards is saying this is stuff that we want, and then they're hiring people who are exceptionally experienced game designers, who've worked on the game for years to put this stuff out. So it's like I guess that is third party support. I don't know if it's related to what Mike was talking about, but
I was just kind of general open-ended question. You expect to see something come out, but yeah, there have been several. Fifth edition fantasy number one Glitter Doom by Goodman Games that came out a few weeks ago. They had a couple. The Fae Sisters Fate is another adventure for fifth edition Goodman Games put out. So there've been several companies putting out stuff, just kind of under the auspices of the OGL.
Yeah, it's strange. I don't know. I'm not quite certain whether that's. I'm not quite certain what the arrangement is there. So there might be as you say, it looks like there's lots of stuff that's been sort of coming out from Goodman, and I think Necromancer too. So I don't know. Maybe Wizards is working with them right now to put out lots of D&D stuff. But I have no idea because I haven't been working on it.
No, that's cool. I was just curious. Yeah, both those books I mentioned from Goodman actually had an OGL statement in the back, so I was...
Oh, okay.
I was thinking legally that's how they're doing it, but, obviously Hasbro might have different ideas at some point down the line, so, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, like I said, it was one of those questions you probably can't answer, but it's something, just as a publisher, I've been curious about, so...
Sure. Yeah, if I knew, I would tell you that I couldn't say, but I actually just don't know.
I know. I can turn off recording here for a second, and we can, just talk comfortably if you want.
I still don't know.
I do feel bad for you, Steve, because from what you just described, you did not get the most important letter in the D&D Monster Manual.
Is that D?
Yeah, well, obviously, right? Because you got demons and devils and dragons and drow. I mean, we all know that if you only got one letter of the Monster Manual, you could build a whole adventure just with D.
Yeah, you could, and I'm really kind of grateful I didn't get that letter because it. it's huge. Do you have a copy of the book?
No, I haven't seen it yet. My local game store said I can't see it till next week.
Yeah, I think Friday, but really, honestly, D starts on page, I've got it right in front of me, D starts on page 46, and it goes to page, let's see, man, it's big. People who have the table of contents could tell you, it goes to page 122.
Yeah, the hardcover is 352 pages.
Grand. So it's 80, the letter D is 80 pages.
If that's the way the math works out.
Well, he's a professor, so I'll take his word on that.
So Rob Schwalb did D, and he writes faster than I do. He's been at it longer, and I was really glad that he got D, because it was just I was watching the D section come through when we were working on it. I was just like, holy crap. I mean, it's just gigantic with demons, devils, and dragons, drow. Those are huge entries. G was, I think, the biggest letter for me. G is pretty big. You have, these golems, giants. Giants are big.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Gotcha. Yes, you did. So, can I ask you some stuff about the mechanics?
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about them. I mean, I know them from them with the adventure stuff that I've been working on, but I did the story tech for the book, so I don't know a lot about the mechanical development of the monsters.
Oh, so you wrote like the background stuff, but you didn't come up with things like powers and numbers.
Correct. Not for the monster manual. I wrote the story text for for every other letter, but I didn't do the mechanics.
Oh, I see. Interesting.
That was Rodney and Peter, I believe. The stars of Lords of Waterdeep.
Ah.
Yep, so Rodney Thompson and Peter Lee, I believe, are the ones who did all that mechanical work.
Well, then I won't ask you about the mechanics. I'll ask you about the story instead. So,
and Chris Sims. Chris Sims also.
In fourth, you know, the setting was very particular with this sort of points of light idea, mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right? But the fifth, what is the equivalent in fifth, or is there an equivalent? What were the setting assumptions in
fifth? So, that is good question. Great question. Because I wanted to know that myself at the beginning of the book when we were working on it. We had a whole bunch of story briefs when we started the work where the D&D R&D, the story team, sent us out, you know, monster write-ups and said, this is what we want in the monster. And it was stuff that the story team had talked about as they'd looked at the monsters from previous editions, and that they had offered to the community on the Wizards site saying, does this sound like this monster? And I think, do you guys remember when they were
filled out many surveys? Yep.
Yep. And James Wyatt was in charge of doing all that. So we, Rob and I were handed all that information. And, as I was going through it, I noticed all this mention of the Outer Planes and the Wind Dukes of Aqua and the Plane of Limbo and the Elemental Plane of Water. So as I began to work on the Monster Manual, as I started working my way through the beginning letters, I started to use the first edition manual, The Planes, as my story bible. And I didn't, you know, it was Chris Perkins sent that, you know, sent us a link to the PDF and you know, got my old book on my shelf. But we didn't have a discussion that said this is the world of the fifth edition. And I don't know that there had been, you know, that decision made at that time exactly. Maybe it had been. But as I just noticed that all these monsters in their story briefs were affixed to the old cosmology. And so I started looking at the old cosmology as the world of fifth edition Dungeons and Dragons. And I think, in my opinion, that's true. That's what the world is. Because, like, you can say, that Forgotten Realms is sort of the assumed default setting of D&D, or at least in the player's handbook. But if you're talking about monsters, you know, a lot of monsters come from the Outer Planes, and the Outer Planes is not the Forgotten Realms. It's all of the worlds of D&D. So I guess that's the answer I'll go with, is that the world of the 5th edition Dungeons and Dragons is the manual, The Planes, from the 1st edition. But with a few, you know, tweaks to the way the planes operate. Like, the Plane of Water isn't necessarily just complete water up and down all the way around. I think now there's, like, most of it is underwater, but there's a surface that, you know, the adventurers are assumed to explore upon.
Well, you just made every Planescape fan happy.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, you've got Modrons, you've got, you know, all kinds of Planescape creatures occupying the Monster Manual, so... And I used a lot of Planescape stuff when I was researching as well.
Steve, how often did you get to work with the artists?
Unfortunately, I didn't get to work with the artists at all. Usually art is done after all the design work. So I didn't see any of the art until this summer. right before Gen Con. When I saw the book, I was like, whoa. I had no idea. I didn't know when, in a lot of these times you're working on a book a year out. So you don't know, you don't even know if monsters that you write are going to end up in the book sometimes.
And when you saw the art coming in, did some of it, did you look at it and say, oh my God, that's exactly what I had in my head? Or did you look at some of it and go, that's new?
Mostly the former, a couple of the latter where I was like, huh, because for the most part, I think the art is gorgeous. I think you guys have been seeing it online, and I love the hand painted style of the art. It's in my opinion really lavish. It's the most beautiful monster manual I think that I've seen. Let me think of stuff that in particular really. I think I love the Yeti. That's one that's really near and dear to my heart, because back in fourth edition, Yeti was one of my first monsters I did for as a freelancer. What it really was I had an assignment to come up with two monsters of my own for Monster Manual 3, and I picked one from my campaign that had just evolved spontaneously because the characters went away that I didn't want them to go, and I had to throw stuff in their path, and I came up with a mountain howler kind of beast that had horns and these horrible howls that petrified them. They had this incredible sense of smell. And I just made these monsters up on the spur of the moment. I used stats for a minotaur, and I just dressed them up like wampas and threw them at the characters and just sent wave after wave after them to pin them down in a place so I could think of the next thing to do, because they weren't doing what I thought they would do. And so I sent those monsters in, and they got changed to because they were so much like Yeti, and there weren't Yeti in fourth edition. When Monster Manual 3 came out, they were renamed as Yeti, and in my world, they were called the Thorghul, is what they were called. And so what you'll see is that every time you see a Yeti ever since fourth edition, like if you're looking at the Neverwinter Nights online game, they all have big horns and they howl. And that's because the characters in my, in my game went the wrong way, and I was trying to pin them down. So when I see this picture of the Yeti with these horns, every time I see horns on a Yeti, I go, yeah, that's because I tell the players, I say, that's your contribution is the horned Yeti. So when I saw the picture of the Yeti in this book with these horns and howling, I was like, this is awesome. So, that in answer to your question, that's my, that's one of the ones where I was like, yeah, that's part of my world right there. That's my contribution to D&D in some ways.
Have you thought about taking your world and putting that out for fans to enjoy?
I don't, if I was going to do it, I would probably do it in fiction, and it's a lot different from your standard D&D assumptions. I don't know that it's different enough. I would do it in my own fiction, I think. Go ahead.
Tell us about your fiction. We don't know what you write.
I read a lot of weird stuff that really has nothing to do with D&D. I do everything from, I don't have a whole lot of it published. And most of the stuff that I've done, I've done for games. One of the ones I'm the most proud of is a story called Songs Without Words that I did for a friend's game called Steamscapes North America. It's a Savage Worlds setting supplement. And I did a story. He said, I just need you to write a story that could be set in a steampunk America in the Old West. He said, you can write anything you want. I said, do you have like automatons in your world? He said, yeah. So I said, all right, great. So I wrote a story about a piano playing automaton that is probably the most polished thing I've turned in for any RPG, for really any work at all. And that is that's purely fiction, because I wrote that story without any, without really much knowledge of his world or Savage Worlds at all. I keep I when I left the theater, which is what I did at first, I started writing fiction, and as I was learning how to do it, because I think any craft that you undertake, you have this apprenticeship time where you're just figuring out what the hell you're doing. So I was figuring out fiction when I got game design work. And then I started taking game design work, and I keep saying yes to offers that come along and kind of wanting to go back to fiction, but it's hard because you sort of end up writing on the chance of maybe this thing getting published someplace. Whereas in if you're writing for D&D and Wizards says, hey, here's the thing we're going to pay you for that's going to be out next year, and it's going to be all around the world. It's hard to turn that work down.
I heard an interesting story very similar to that from Chris McLaughlin, who does a lot of the writing for Mutants and Masterminds. In fact, he was the main writer on the book that just won the Emmy this year, the Emerald City guidebook. Mm-hmm. He was breaking his back trying to get into comics and just not making much progress, because it's a tough market to break into. And he had all these friends who were working for, various role-playing companies, including Green Ronin, and he got writing work there, and, it's just kind of continued because, that's where his contacts are, and that's where he gets published, and he's been very successful there.
Yeah. Yeah, I keep thinking that, I keep meaning to go back, and I sometimes, when I have a break, I go back and work at it. And I write every day. Like, I write non-fantasy fiction every day. Some of it's literary fiction type stuff, which is just about contemporary world with ordinary characters. In fact, because I write so much D&D stuff, I almost never write like a typical swords and sorcery fantasy thing, just because I spend so much time in it,
Do you ever feel burned out on that genre and, just in general, the heroic fantasy thing, or is that, kind of evergreen for you?
As far as writing for D&D, you mean?
Well, just, writing, playing, either just kind of having your headspace into, the swords and sorcery kind of stuff.
I do. I definitely do. And I need to take breaks, and I do take breaks. Like, I'll run a game for a while. Every setting that I play, though, is I don't think I've played in a published setting. I don't think I've run a published setting since, in high school I was running Forgotten Realms, but that was up to like 1992. And I've just been, every time I play, seriously, I make up my own world. Like I was telling you, we were making up a microscope setting over the summer for our D&D game. We just used microscope, and we said we don't have to, this doesn't have to have anything to do with D&D. We'll just, we'll just make whatever world we want, and so it's different than your Forgotten Realms or your Dragonlance or your Tolkien. And so I guess that's what keeps it fresh for me is developing new worlds and in finding a D&D in playing D&D in it. I just said, well, it's microscope. So you're just going to lay out, multiple ages of a world. And one of those ages will be an age where, people will wield swords and use some kind of, power, that's not really a problem. So, I try to keep myself interested by making new worlds to delve into that don't, where it doesn't assume the basic assumptions of let's say Forgotten Realms or Tolkien.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question about this.
Sure.
So Mike Lafferty here and I and Walt and other people are, we do the same thing. We also make our own settings. Maybe even with an eye towards publication, in using fifth edition. Mm-hmm. Are we going to have, what challenges are we going to have using the Monster Manual in our original settings? Are we going to have to throw out all that wonderful background stuff that you wrote? How much of it are we going to be able to keep?
I think that's a tough question. I think that the background stuff is pretty, it's hard to say because it it's not as setting specific as, say, Monster Vault Threats to the Nenter Vale, which is a book I worked on a while ago, because that was very setting specific, which I think is one of its strengths.
Yeah.
This is not as setting specific, which in a way is a little bit of a detriment, because in Monster Vault Threats to the Nenter Vale, you could link all the monsters together, and it felt like a campaign setting that was a monster manual.
Right.
Here, you're going to have stuff like, you're going to have, I've got the, next to the Yeti is the Zorn. And it says, bizarre creatures native to the elemental plane of Earth. Zorn sniff out gemstones and precious metals. So, you've got a link to the elemental plane of Earth now. So, does the elemental plane of Earth exist in your cosmology or in your world? But the rest of it, as far as Zorn sniffing out precious metals and tunneling through the rock, is all pretty general. I think that the monster manual is mostly general, but there are a lot of ties to stuff in D&D mythology, especially the planes, like we were talking about before.
Right.
Like for the Yeti, there's no mention of specific places. It's just, in the mountains, in the snowy mountains.
Sure.
So
if you were dropping the Yeti into the D&D game that you're running right now, could you do that with like minimal alteration?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I am using them. There's a, in the setting that we established, asteroid hit the world and split it open, and demons crawled out of the middle and decimated everybody on one continent, and the rest of humanity fled to the farthest reaches of the north. So they're living in the tundra now because the rest of the world is inhabited by demons. So I'm like, what do we want to do with, and I started to decide that a lot of the monsters that exist in the world are people that were inhabited by demons. So demons aren't just the things that are labeled demons in the monster manual. Demons are like a lot of the monsters that exist. And so Yeti are, because we're in kind of a tundra region, Yeti are a great thing, choice to use. And so, but Yeti I think so far that Yeti are people that have, been possessed and evolved into these horrific lumbering monsters that, that are hungry for flesh and crawl, stalk the outside of civilization. There's some of the demon. These are demons that have made it over the waters to the northern reaches and are now starting to hunt people here. So that's a way that I've used Yeti, and they're going to be essentially the same as they are in the Monster Manual. But there's just one little story difference, and that's that they are not, whatever they are in the Monster Manual. They're things that were people that were changed by demonic influence. Does that make sense? Does that
totally
answer the question? So small story changes to, but using everything else from the Monster Manual as is.
That's interesting. Kind of reminds me of the story of Fafnir in Norse mythology. It was a man who became a dragon because of his greed.
Oh, right. Yeah. In fact, I was thinking of using the, the seven deadly sins to be, to define different kinds of demons. I realized after I said that the Dragon Age sort of did that, but it's a common theme.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, it's really interesting hearing about the development of this. How was it working on it? I mean, I gotta think that there's gotta, when I was in journalism, I once heard a story about writing feature, a how-to article about writing feature stories, and it talked about the problem being a young reporter at the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times is you feel the ghosts of all the previous writers and editors who've ever worked there looking over your shoulder, as you're at the keyboard trying to compose. Do you ever have that kind of feeling where, the ghost of Gary Gygax is right behind you saying, hey, don't fuck this up, kid, as you're...
Sure. And when I took out the... I did it first, definitely. Because, I haven't worked on this is my first core book to work on. So this is, this is huge for me. So there was a lot of, anticipation and anxiety as I was working on it. But, as I did it, each monster, I went through the original sources. I went through the AD&D Monster Manual, the second edition Monster Manual, the third edition, the fourth edition, and then I would look at ecology articles where I could, or stuff like Planescape. Are we still connected?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Sorry.
We're still here.
What I would find, though, is that what we wanted to do with this book was to make it a really story-oriented book. So you go back to the first Monster Manual and you look for, you know, like story material, and there's usually a little bit of it, you know, there's the idea of the monster there and then some stuff on its attacks and what its abilities are. But in the AD&D Monster Manual, which is near and dear to my heart because it's the first AD&D book I think I had was Monster Manual 2, it doesn't really do that. It's just not what it had in mind. It gives you a little bit on the monster, but it's usually a really pretty short paragraph with a couple things on its attacks. So then I go to the Monster Manual second edition, which for me has always been like the monstrous manual has always been like kind of the holy grail of monster manuals. I felt like it had, you know, it had tons of information on monsters. It had lots of story material on monsters. But then I read through it. I still think it's a great book, but there's a lot of stuff in that story in those entries that I didn't, that wasn't quite as useful as I thought. You still have a lot of stuff about attacks and damage, which in this monster manual or in the stat block, you also have a lot of, it seems like you have a standard ecological entry for every monster in the second edition monster manual, like where it lays its eggs and, you know, when the mating season is, and I'm exaggerating that a little bit, but, I'm not disparaging anybody that likes that information. But you know, as a teenager and even as an adult, like finding that information in every monster entry. There are some monsters that don't need it, and some where it kind of put me to sleep, and I just never used it because that's not important to the story that I'm telling. So in this monster manual, we use that information where it's necessary. We use it where it's informative or where it might play into a story. But then the rest of that is up to you to do. I think like in the ANCAG, I included a bunch of that stuff. And then Chris Perkins was reading it over and he's like, you know what? It's a little fat. Your entry's a little fat. And I went over and looked it over and, you know, I had included, lots of stuff from the original about how they're sent, you know, that their scent infuses different caverns and how they tunnel through the earth and what you might find in that area. And, you know, we cut it down. I guess what I'm saying is that those monster manuals are all very different from this one. And this, I feel like the later fourth edition monster manuals and this one take a more of a story first approach, and because that's what you're using a monster for ultimately. You want it to tell a part of your story. And sure, you can throw lots of monsters. You can play D&D like just throw waves of monsters and kill them and get the experience points and the treasure. But I think that with video games, we don't really need to do that. We don't want to do that as much in RPGs, just because we can do it so much more efficiently. And a video game. And a lot of the times when we're coming to RPGs now, it's like the hot RPGs are our story games. And this is the time where we can sit down and tell a story with our friends. That's why I feel like that's why we're sitting down at the table a lot to play role-playing games. So yes, in the fifth edition of the game, with these story entries, I didn't feel that pressure so much of the past peering down on me because I was writing a very different kind of book than those were.
Yeah, you kind of make a good point that the hobby has kind of, you know, changed to some extent, because if you're the guy who really likes killing things and stealing their stuff, you can probably scratch that itch a whole lot easier in World of Warcraft or about a half dozen other games I can think of easily.
You don't have to, like, get out of your house and, you know, go to your friend's house with a giant bag of books on your bike and bring all your dice and sit down and make sure that you have the time in the evening and wait for your turn to roll, you know, a D20 and 5D6 or whatever to get the satisfaction of killing, you know, a monster. You can sit down and in the time that it took you to do that, you can sit down on a good video game RPG and do that, do loads of that in, you know, in an hour.
Yeah, I'm reminded, I had a buddy living with me for a while back in my bachelor days, and we'd go to the local game store and, you know, peruse the shelves and see what was up, and we were both really into superhero RPGs. And we were both kind of new in Denver, and I was like, you know, we should just put up an ad in the game store, find some guys who aren't too crazy, have them come over and, you know, play Mutants and Masterminds or something. And he's like, you know, why don't we just get City of Hero accounts and, you know, just play it from the computer room. And,
yeah, totally. And I like, you know, I like, sometimes it's fun to just throw waves of monsters and try to get through a, you know, like a simple monster stomping adventure. But I don't want to do it for, I don't want to do it endlessly, you know,
well,
like, and just waves after waves.
And I think maybe the story approach, and I'm being a little pretentious here, but I think maybe that's maybe what you do, you can do better in tabletop than you can do on a computer.
You know, I remember the accusation that 4th edition D&D was like World of Warcraft. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that, right?
Yep.
And I would think, it's nothing like World of Warcraft. I mean, it used a couple of words like tanking and striker. You know, I mean, it used some vocabulary. But it's nothing like that. And it was always, and I think you're touching on this point that I hadn't really thought about before, that playing a lot of these online video games is basically about grinding. You know, a lot of it is about fighting monsters very efficiently. It's a lot of fun. I play these games a lot, so I love killing me some Klingons in Star Trek Online as much as anybody. But it's never going to compete with the social interaction,
right,
of the tabletop game.
I mean, when Mass Effect 3 came out, and I'm not really a guy who goes and plays like cooperative online killing missions. But when they added the cooperative, I forget what it was even called. It was like a cooperative element where you get on and fight 11 waves of monsters and try to survive. Yeah. And I thought, I'm not going to be interested in that. And then I played it once, and then I got some experience and leveled, and then I got some stuff, and I got new equipment, and then I played it again. And every 15 minutes, and I spent, I won't lie to you, I played 500 hours of that game. I got, like, every medal you could possibly get because it's fun. Like, I like doing that, I guess, as much or maybe even more than more than I thought I did. But, like, yeah. I could do it. I could just, like, for, you know, it took me 15 minutes to waste through 11 rounds of that on, like, on the easier and challenges. And, like, on the half-an-hour challenge, and the silver challenges, it would be, like, half an hour. And on the gold, maybe 45 minutes. But, you know, I really love to do that. But I can, you know, as I said, I can just sit down on my couch and do that in right away. And then D&D, you know, it's not necessarily what I want to do anymore. In the 80s when you know, I had a Atari 800 XL.
That's right.
That wouldn't do that very well. Or when I had a Texas Instruments, a TI-99-4A, and was playing Tunnels of Doom, you know, that you have to put in the cassette and then, you know, play that. I swear I even remember the binary code where you go, you know, like I had the tune memorized to the binary code on the tape because that took a lot longer to do, and it was easier to play D&D and just be like, okay, you know, we kill, like, we'll go through Keep on the Borderlands and slaughter all the orcs and kobolds. But that's also what kind of game D&D sort of was back then, you know. Yeah. And it's just sort of, it's evolved, I think, in my opinion, over time. And I'm not disparaging, just combat sweeps, but, I don't know. I feel like the audience of the game has sort of shifted to wanting to sit down and you know, people want to be badass in combat and kill monsters. It's a game of heroic fantasy, you know, for the most part. But, you know, I think people want a little bit more meat with it now.
Yeah. You know, at the same time, I have to applaud 5th edition a lot because it's gone back. It's got a lot of old school influence in there.
It does.
And if people want to just do the dungeon crawl where they kill monsters and take their stuff, it's much easier to do now than it was in 4th or in 3rd.
You're right. I totally agree.
Yeah.
You're just, you're reminiscing, reminding me of the old days, man, like playing Fantasy, Phantasie. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't have it, but I remember it.
I played that on a Commodore 64.
Yeah, I had a VIC 20, man. Yep.
And maybe it was a VIC 20. It might have been before the 64. And then Curse of the Azurbans.
Ah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Love that game.
Pool of Radiance. Cool. Hillzafar was the next one, then Curse of the Azurbans. And then, it was the one with the Savage Frontier cover on the front, I think, after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I lost weeks and weeks of real time, I think, in those worlds. So,
yep. Oh. Yep.
Wow, kind of surprised. It kind of seems like it would be a lot of fun to, you know, redo those video games today with, you know, modern technology, but who knows who has the rights at this point.
Oh, I'd be such a sucker for that.
Oh. I'd have to divorce my wife. And then spend all the time I spend on relationship and baby stuff now playing those games, because that's how much of my time it would take up. But
I apologize for all those to my wife for all those Mass Effect hours, and she was like, because she gave me the game for my birthday, she was like, no, I'm glad you're enjoying your present. So, but you know, I haven't played Skyrim because people are like, you know, my gamer friends are like, you got to play Skyrim, it's so great, and you know, you'll just play it all the time. And I said, that's why I haven't played it.
Yeah, you know, I saw a review of Destiny that basically said, well, there's a lot of problems with the game, but this guy's biggest problem in this particular review on Polygon was it's not for a guy who has a career and kids, because there's no,
right.
It's an online game. There's no pause button. You know,
yeah.
My wife's working, there's a guy at the door with the pizza, and I can't get up to answer it because I'm fighting off wave, a wave, a wave while I'm, you know, waiting for this timer to go down on this mission. And, you know, you know, some guys have the free time to do that, say if you're in college or, you know, something like that. But, yeah, as you get older, you know, your situation changes.
It's true. It's true. And, it's true. even playing RPGs is tough, you know, because you gotta arrange those schedules around, you know, significant others and children. As once you get into your 30s, you start saying, you know, where are all those folks I was playing RPGs with? You know, everybody's got obligations, and it's a lot harder to schedule a game, I find.
Yeah, and I've done all my gaming the last 3 or 4 years over Skype.
That's becoming the thing.
Yeah.
I use Google Hangout for all of my... I run Ars Magica.
Oh, boy. You are old school.
Well, yeah.
Can we announce that thing you're doing related to Ars Magica, or is that still quiet? Hush.
It's sort of... I got permission to write an Ars Magica novel.
Oh, wow.
That's
awesome.
Yeah, thank you. But I have so much other crap on my plate, I haven't been able to get to it yet. You know, it's kind of been the same situation as, you know, what you were talking about, Stephen, although not as as lucrative as yours. but who knows? Well, I'm in academia, you know, and so I have a lot of academic articles that I'm constantly writing for publication, promotion, tenure purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, well, I can write these articles on, because I write about superheroes. I teach classes on superhero comics. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm really, really lucky. So I can write this article about the animal superhero and trace its evolution through Batman and so on up to characters like Animal Man. And I can write that article, or I can write this Ars Magica novel. And I really want to write the Ars Magica novel. On the other hand, the Batman article is so fun. So I'm kind of in a target-rich environment. But I have to write one of them because I want to keep my job and get promoted. So.
Right. Like, that's exactly what I was talking about before, you know? I mean, as far as writing fiction, is that I practice fiction every day.
Yeah.
But I don't ever have time to go back and revise it, because I've, you know, if I'm working on a game thing, then I, you know, when do I do that? I spend all the rest of my day doing the game thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, hey, speaking of shifting priorities, my wife and kid are going to be home in about 20 minutes, so I need to start dinner.
Stephen, thank you so much for coming. This is a great conversation. I learned so much.
Hey, I had a great time, and thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, this has been awesome.
Yeah, good talking to you. I got a couple more minutes. Were there any last-minute questions or anything else someone wanted to get into the conversation before we wrap up?
Just quick, do you know if there are going to be any plans for digital releases of physical books?
I don't know a whole lot about that, but I think that the Dungeonscape software is where to find all that info, because they've been talking about that stuff lately.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen this, Walt, but the Dungeonscape is going to be like an iPad. Like, you can create characters and make dungeons and like a DM's helper kind of thing, too.
That's pretty groovy.
I've been reading Mike's comments lately, where, you know, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Somebody when I said earlier, I said, you know, stuff that Mike says sometimes ends up being the stuff that is actually going on. Where somebody asked Mike that question about digital books maybe a month ago, and he goes, well, I don't know, you know, wouldn't it be interesting? He goes, it might be cool to be able to have an app where you had all, you know, like where you're able to like upgrade and have books on the app that went into D&D. And then Dungeonscape said, this is what we're doing. You know, I don't quote me on that, because this is some of this is just me speculating. I think like I scroll through, say, EN World, and I read these articles, but you know, it seems to me that that's what, didn't they say something like that last month?
Well,
around Gen Con?
It's another third party as well. It's like not done by the guys at Wizards. It's done by another company.
Right. It's Trapdoor.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of weird how much third party support there is for a game that doesn't actually have official third party support announced. But yeah, cool. That's I'll have to check that out. I hadn't realized there was an app like that.
Well, it's not out yet. But we can. They've got a blog up and an ad. You know.
Exactly.
So they're sort of walking you through the creation process, and they have some goals for the project, but they haven't yet revealed, for example, how it will be monetized.
Exactly.
So we don't know if there's going to be a subscription fee or if it's going to be, you know, we don't know.
Yeah. I've been following all this stuff, and so I've been reading articles on it and watching videos on it. And there was a big interview at Gen Con that I watched on EN World, a couple weeks ago, so where there was lots of information on that. So, I'm speculating that that's one way that it might be done, but it might be done as PDFs. I have no idea whether it will. It's interesting because I had some, while I was working on the thing for Sasquatch, I had access to folders with, in Dropbox folders with partial, you know, with more or less complete books on them, right? Like the monster manual and stuff and the player's handbook. And so I'm going through those and I'm trying to use them on my iPad and I'm trying to use them on my computer. And it is a pain in the ass to use with all that art.
Right.
And so as I was using it, I was like, you know, I don't really want I thought I wanted a PDF of like the player's handbook and the monster manual, and it turns out I don't, because I want the information, but I don't really want I also want to have the book, because the book is gorgeous. But I think in the past it's like 4th edition and 3rd edition, there was lots of information in the PDF and there was art. But you wanted the information, and the information was all there. And here it's like they've made these books so that they're these lush, beautiful things to hold in your hand and look at. So, I think that if the Dungeonscape app allowed access to the information, then I would probably be happy with that, because, even on an iPad, trying to get through page after page of art, it's just like little spinny wheel. I was running my first game with my first 5e game right before the Monster Manual came out. I was just using one of my things from the Dropbox, and the
And I was playing with a guy who worked at Apple, and he's like, I said, oh, I wish I had a, you know, a brand new iPad. And he goes, you know, with the amount of art you're trying to go through, it, you really wouldn't see that big a difference, just because it's, these PDFs are huge that you're going through. So, yeah, I hope that, that whatever they do, I really don't need a, just speaking for myself, I don't really need a version of the Monster Manual or the Player's Handbook on that's complete on the, whatever they decide to do with it. Like, I don't know that people are going to be really happy with that. Or at least my experience with a partial version was kind of like, eh, I'd rather flip through the book or just have access to the information somehow.
Yeah, I'm kind of grumpy about that sometimes. I call that coffee table book syndrome. I mean, some of these RPG books are just amazing. Mm-hmm. I think Walt mentioned to me he's got one of the Green Ronin books. Maybe, boy, what's that one you have as a screensaver at work, Walt?
Oh, for the Mastermind's Manual with the huge guy in the he's in the giant control room.
Yeah,
that guy from Shadow.
Yeah. Some of these books, I mean, they're just amazing looking, but, you know, if you want to print out a page or a few pages for easy reference, you know, you only carry the whole book, or you, like you say, you're looking at them on a device, I mean, yeah, just the situation you described, a little spinny wheel.
Yeah, that's why I'm hoping that the Trapdoor app is awesome and lets you, you know, really facilitates the games in that way. And from what I've seen so far, you know, just through the videos and stuff that they've done, it looks like it might be that. So I think maybe the answer to your question is, you know, it might be, you know, the official Wizards backed Trapdoor Dungeonscape software. That might be it.
All right,
groovy.
That's just my guess.
Well, we'll keep our eyes out and see what happens. Steve, it's been great talking to you. Could we maybe bring you back at some point in the future to continue this conversation?
It's been a pleasure. I'd love to come back anytime.
All right. Hey, thanks, Steve. Walt, Jason, always a pleasure having you guys on.
Thank you very much, sir.
And to our beloved listeners, thanks for tuning in. Please help spread the word about the podcast, and we'll see you next time on the BAMF Podcast.